Audio for the Retro Computing Roundtable is hosted by CyberEars. When you need a rock-solid platform to host and distribute your podcast or other audio media, head over to CyberEars.com. Fast, reliable hosting with unlimited bandwidth. CyberEars is your audio on your terms.
It's May 3rd, 2020, and welcome to episode 213 of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now, and my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, there's just one thing I'd like to know. Will I ever find my way back to Oz?
Will I ever... The RCR is a podcast about retro computer news, nostalgia, collecting, things we hate, things we love. Speaking of things we love, let's talk about the various co-hosts. We love our co-hosts. I'm going to go clockwise, and really clockwise this time. I'm going to start with Paul, because that's clockwise. How you doing, Paul? And by the way, if you're listening to this podcast in the car, you're, what the heck is he talking about clockwise? We're streaming live on YouTube. You're always free to watch us, and you're free not to, which is actually probably a better choice for you. But
if you're driving, yes.
Especially if you're driving. But Paul, how are you doing, my friend?
I am doing fine. I think I've probably left my apartment, you know, three times in 4 weeks.
That is the correct way to do it.
Good job. Hashtag stay home.
Yeah. Right. Exactly. Wash your hands.
That's right. Don't touch your face. Yeah.
Don't touch my face.
But Carrington.
Okay. Touch my face.
I don't know. Yeah. It's been the school year is basically ending now. Classes have ended, such that they were. So,
did you do remote learning with your students?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, there was remote activities. I don't know how much learning happened.
Well, I was going to ask, how did it go for you?
It was, it was interesting. You know, I think it's making the best of what we've got available, but not ideal.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, no, it's, you know, it's a little bit of, there's a little bit of contact with people outside, so that's also not bad.
I was just curious from the professor's perspective, because my daughter had to come home. She had to leave the dorm, as I talked about, and she actually took over my gadget room, so I had to give up my computer room. Everything's all like stacked behind me here. But yeah, so I got her impression of the remote learning, the end of a school year, you know, and this new normal. But I was just curious from a professor's point of view, what you thought of it.
It's kind of, I think it's a little hard to keep people, you know, it's like some people will show up and, you know, some people will not. And when they don't show up, you don't know how they're doing at all. You know, I mean, it's pretty easy for people to fall under the radar. It's suddenly a lot of work to try to keep track of everybody and that kind of stuff. So yeah, it's, I think if this were planned, it would work out maybe okay. But this, you know, sort of falling into it in the middle is not great. So kind of glad we're through with that part. You know, at least what I mean is I'm through with that part of the semester. We're still all stuck at home. But
right. Well, how are you doing, Jack?
Oh, pretty good. I'm, similarly, I have not left my apartment much at all lately. I don't think I've actually stepped outside my apartment since Thursday, except I opened the balcony door and stepped onto it today. But it's, and it's partly because of everything going on, and partly because I have no reason to, and also just like, it's just terrible weather. Like, Stockholm is just, I don't know, we have like the weirdest season of all time. I swear that like, but since October or September, maybe even, we've had like this span of temperatures that is kind of, I don't know, it's just terrible. Even if it's sunny, it's not warm.
Well, that might almost be a mixed blessing. I mean, here in the U.S., we've had some areas that the weather's been particularly nice.
Right.
And in those places, people are chomping at the bit
right
to get out and do things. So,
yeah. Like when I do go walk around Stockholm, I do see that, I mean, there are people out doing stuff. It's less than usual, but it's not like a ghost town. And almost no one is wearing masks. Like if I can count on one hand, I can be out for 2 hours and count on one hand how many masks I see. It's just not really a thing people are doing here at all.
Yeah. Well, Sweden has gotten some notoriety for that decision as well.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know how it's all going to shake out. It seems like it's – I mean, Sweden's not doing well compared to its neighbors, you know, compared to Denmark and Norway and such. So,
both statistically?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah,
like cases?
And... more cases, more deaths, like per capita.
Hmm.
And it seems to be probably a result of not making more stringent moves to get people to stay at home.
Hmm.
So, I don't know. We'll see.
Yeah.
So far, I mean, it hasn't affected me much. I haven't really had a lot of people here that I know or am aware of who have caught it or had it. There have been a couple of celebrities who have caught it and one who died and that sort of thing. But it's not – I have more, way more old friends in the U.S. who have actually had it and been okay. But I don't really know anyone here who's had it yet, for sure.
Yeah, I just know a friend of a friend, and that was in Washington State. Mm-hmm. Which kind of makes sense because Washington State was one of the flashpoints,
right.
The early flashpoints for the U.S.
Right.
So, Well, I wish you well, obviously.
Thank you. Same.
And what about you, Carrington?
I don't go outside.
Okay.
Got nothing to do with COVID. I just don't like
Are you
people.
Scared of sunburn?
Yes. Like... yes, I am. I am pale and I just go from pale to charcoal. Just boom, red, boom, explodes. Canada or Toronto anyway is very good for mask wearing. Everyone's got masks, but there's still way too many people going outside. Like they just, it's frustrating. I don't go out much, but I see it when I'm on my commute to work and stuff. Cause I still have to go to work, but not often. And I'm the only person in the front half of a building. So it's just like literally me. Cool. So everybody else has been able to work remotely. So I just show up and it's me and, you know, 2,500 square feet of my own space. So I'm pretty good at distancing. It's like no one come near me. Don't come within 700 feet of me. That's usually not an issue, to be honest. Yeah, doing fine. You know, lots of masks here, and but you know, still scary times. I wanted to not be like this. Make this not be like this, please. Get on that.
Me
Earl.
Too. Let's write me a too. Letter.
Yeah.
I mean, Oregon's pretty good on the masks. Oregon has been very good on the distancing. We had a stay-at-home order pretty early, and the curve here has been flat. The problem is, when I look at the numbers, the curve is staying flat.
Same
it's interesting.
Here.
It's not going down, but it's not going up like exponentially. It's just kind of sticking around like, you know, a bad penny.
Yep. And weather's getting nice here, and Canadians like stay indoors all winter. And then as soon as the weather gets nice, everybody wants to go out to cottages, patios, stuff like that. So I'm really worried in like 2 weeks from now, there's going to be a lot of people outdoors. And 2 weeks after that, there'll be a lot of people in hospitals. So we will see.
Yeah, me too.
But everyone
the Pacific Northwest is very much like that as well. Mm. You know, we stay in the rain, and then when the sun comes out, it's
get that
like
one good week a year, and then let's go.
The whole city blooms. Yeah, somebody said, when is summer in Portland? I said, last year it was on a Thursday.
Yeah. So it seemed, I don't know. So I'm hoping things go okay. We will see. So fingers crossed, not everybody dies. Woohoo!
Well, let's talk about some fun stuff. Why not?
Like stuff we hated.
Stuff we hate.
We hate coronavirus. We hate.
I think that's universal. So actually the host topic really is things that we either came to hate or that we no longer hate. So
it's a hate-filled episode on RCR.
Yes, that's right. We've got the drama. You want the drama. Here we are. So I'm going to go in the same order. I don't know who actually suggested this host topic, but
it's hate. It's probably me.
Think about it, because there's not a lot of things that I hate from the computer world.
Unless but... I have scrolls, baby.
Okay. We'll save the lion's share of the time for you. Paul, why don't you start?
Yeah. Well, of course, I didn't actually give this a whole lot of thought, you know, even despite us having prepared this well in advance. But I know that, you know, the kinds of things that come to mind are things like, you know, the floppy drive on a single floppy drive Mac, where, you
good
know,
choice.
you pretty much, you boot up your System 7 or System 6, I guess, and then you have to eject the disk and put in your Microsoft Word disk and eject the disk. And, you know, and as soon as it wants to load some font or something, you have to, you know, it spits out your disk and you have to stick in your system disk again. And, you know, these are the things that I don't remember very deeply when I remember fondly back into the old days. but, you know, occasionally, oh, what was I doing? I think I was trying to install, it was probably trying to install something like, you know, system 753 or something like that. And you could, it was, there was a time when you could download this from the Apple site and you could get, you know, the 13 disks or whatever it is. And they did actually have, I think, for some of these things, network installs, so that you basically, you didn't have to keep doing this, you know, insertion of disks thing. But I know that I had tried that with a couple of these where it really is like 12, 13 disks or whatever that, you insert it, you wait 30 seconds, so you can't leave, you know, it's not quite long enough to go do anything. Anyway, so that's something that I came to hate and don't really miss, I guess, is kind of, you know, like, it's one of those things that reminds me when I do start using emulators and things that things have improved a bit.
That was not fun. We installed Windows NT at a company I was working for in the 90s, and we were going to do the European tour where we went several places, including Sweden. That's when I first came to Sweden. We were doing Sweden and the Netherlands and France and Germany, and we ordered ahead to make sure that the NT software was in all the offices. When we got there, it would be ready to install. But unfortunately, it was the Netherlands office, they shipped us the floppy disk version of NT instead of the CD version. I didn't even know there was a floppy disk version.
I was going to say, why would there even be one? But okay.
Seriously.
How many floppies was
28
that?
28 floppies. 28 3.5-inch floppies. And
that's amazing.
I kid you not, it failed on floppy 24. And while I was installing it and literally taking hours swapping in and out, the Dutch folks nicknamed me Swappy. And they called me that for the rest of my time.
That's going to come back.
So I feel your pain, Paul. I don't like that either.
It seemed like it was particularly bad on the Mac because the Mac was sort of conscious of where things were, and it wasn't all that good at sort of loading things anticipatorily. So there were a bunch of cases where you would just have to keep putting the same.
You go back and forth between two disks a bunch.
What? I don't know. Anyway, I'm glad we no longer have to do that.
Yeah, that was a good one. So what do you have, Jack? Top that.
I don't know if I can top it. That was bad. Like, I never owned a classic Mac really back in the day, but I remember using people's Macs who didn't have a hard drive, say. They just had like floppies and like, oh, here, let's try and, you know, do this thing. And you'd try and put in the floppy to run. And after a while, it's like, can you get it? Put the other one back in. Not fun. But I guess for me, it's more, I remember that when I was pretty new to computers, like when I was a teenager, early teen, and getting into the Atari stuff, I had a lot of this irrational other platform hatred, right? Like, which I think it's probably it's part of that age somehow. And it's part of like, you know, you're forming yourself into some sort of like imaginary clique with other people who you
Becomes part of your identity. I am a whatever person.
Right. Yeah. Right. And like, I remember just feeling like that. I remember that I could be really bothered by like Apple II graphics. Like, this looks terrible. This is awful. This is, how can they stand to use this? How can anybody do this? And really bothered by Commodore 64 graphics. Like, oh, just like these weird blocks all over the screen. And I felt like what I was using was obviously so superior in whatever ways, which in some ways it was, and in some ways it wasn't, you know, in some ways it doesn't really matter. In like, if you're playing a game, like, who cares, you know, the gameplay is much more important than what it actually, than what the, what shade of orange you have on the screen. Right. But like, so for me, it's more, I feel like I'm glad that I've been able to, cause I still see it sometimes. I still have like people in my sphere, acquaintances, who will be like, oh, but like make weird comments because I'm using a Mac, right? Which is like not still, even like, which is not even uncommon nowadays, right? But like, and it's not people I work with, but like, say somebody that I know from some social context, say, oh, well, that's because you're using a Mac, you should be using Windows instead, or whatever. And it's like, and this is a very much a grown man who would say this kind of thing, you know?
Doesn't sound like one,
right? And so to me, I feel like I'm I remember that stage of life where I really hated on stuff that I identified as being not my identity. And I'm glad to have long ago stopped doing that.
100%. I remember that. I remember being basically anti-Microsoft, like, or Windows in particular, like back when I first got into Mac stuff, when I actually like non-jokingly would say I hate a platform versus now where I'm like, ah, you TRSA people or whatever. but Windows, yeah, it was like weirdly bothered by the shape of the mouse pointer for Windows because it's like a skinnier size and drove me crazy. And like I swear I could have just jumped on the Windows bandwagon if the mouse just looked like the Mac mouse, because I got used to a certain shape and the fact that it was a little skinnier would just be like triggering me constantly as I looked at the screen. It was so bizarre. And I think that's one of the things that kept me away from the 2GS, like graphical front, because it had that same skinnier mouse. I'm like, I can't do it. I got a certain mouse shape, the one true mouse shape. I can't move on. I don't know, man. I had some weird things going on in my life, apparently. Like, that would bother me. But there was totally a time when I remember being at Macworld, that time when I think in a couple of videos you can hear me yell it if you listen. There was the Macworld keynote where Bill Gates got up on the big screen and said they were going to invest in Microsoft.
Oh, right.
You listen really carefully, you can hear, like, so yeah, so and Steve Jobs on screen, they bring him up. But then, like, I'm sitting in an audience, it's dark room, and up comes a big face, and you hear from the back a little Carrington yell, "Throw the hammer!" At the end of this video, but that was only like half joking. I'm like, oh, the face of my, I don't know.
You were,
man,
actually
like,
at move on for those things. That conference?
Yeah, I used to go to them all the time. Like, it was a thing.
Wow.
Like, for work, I got sent down. Yeah.
I mean, they memorialized that in the movie Pirates of...
There used to be a time when people would have these things called gatherings and trade shows, and you'd get together. Those long, long past.
I've heard of that.
But there was a time when more than one person would be in a room.
There was indeed, wasn't there?
Yeah, but yeah. Anyway, Jack, same thing. I used to have this thing where you'd identify as like your platform was yourself. But yeah, E3. I remember the first time I got to go to E3. It was like, oh my God, I'm going to E3. It's like an industry thing. Meanwhile, I was just like, go look at a bunch of games. But it seemed cool. Seemed cool at the time. A lot of things seemed cool at the time. So. Anyway, I too was like anti-Microsoft in a weird way. And now I use Windows more than I use Mac, even though I use a Mac at home. I think I spend more time on Windows than Mac. So everybody uses everything nowadays.
Right. Yeah, like, so for me, like I don't have a Windows machine, and I haven't used Windows really in a long time because I'm almost entirely doing iOS development. You know, it's just like it would make no sense. Mm. But I'm starting to think, well, maybe I should get a Windows gaming machine, because I have all these Steam games that don't work anymore. Yep. Thanks, Catalina, 64-bit only.
That was the thin end of the wedge for me. Like, my first personal Windows PC after like years of not using Windows was because I had so many games I wanted to play. I finally said, I'll just get one for games. And then suddenly, I'm just going to have one for a server. I'm just going to – and then now it's not either all over the place. They just multiply.
Right. Yep. That's what it goes. Yeah, but so, I mean, I can also be still jokingly opposed to Microsoft Windows, but it's just like – if there's a utility for me to have it, I will have it, and it's not going to bother me. I won't feel like
I'm not necessarily jokingly opposed to Vista, though. That one still hurts.
Being opposed to that is okay.
I think that was rational. I think most people were rationally opposed to Vista.
But the modern versions, the last two, I've been totally fine with.
Right.
The platform wars were really real. I mean, it was almost like it was your gang.
Yeah.
You know? Like, you're flipping Atari signs at people.
Well, if you were – the thing is, being a Mac user back then let you be one of the underdogs. Like, it was – you'd go into stores and there were no Mac things. And so that's a big part of somebody's identity, especially if it's formative years where you like this thing and you are the underdog. It's really easy to rally around that. So people all either rally around being the popular one, which nowadays, like, I use iOS as my phone. That's the popular one. In a, well, yeah, actually, no. I guess it's still Android. So I'm still the underdog. Yeah, stick it to the man. But back then when you – if you were a Mac user, like, there was barely any Mac software, everyone else was using Windows, so it became this thing you had to justify all the time. I think that becomes part of your identity.
Yep. Mm. It's like a cult.
Yeah. It's so different now.
You think being a Mac user was the underdog. Imagine being an Atari ST user. Oh my God.
Mm-hmm.
Like, try to find a store anywhere in 1989 that was selling Atari ST stuff.
Yeah. Layers of dogs above you.
Yes, exactly. So many dogs above you.
Dogs all the way down.
And the thing is, that was my – I wasn't even exposed to that. I had lots of friends who were Commodore users, so we would make fun of each other, Commodore and Apple people. That became like our go-to thing. But right. I didn't really know anybody else. I had some TRS-80 stuff, but I was the only person I knew with any of that. And I didn't know anybody who was an Atari user. Like, in my crowd, there was nobody. Lots of Commodore users and lots of Apple users. And – almost not. I think it becomes like friends get the same thing friends have, and so schools become like a Commodore school or an Apple school or whatever. And there's just like, I didn't know anybody with Atari stuff. It was only afterwards I kind of got to see the Atari stuff and see the 8-bit Atari things. I think I would have preferred that. That looks amazing. Like, why didn't anybody even tell me about those? I think I would have been a rabid Atari user if I'd just been exposed to it.
Right.
Well, what sort of things do you hate or don't hate anymore, still hate, or have come to hate?
Let's start with people on this call. And I got a list
I've got
things.
Real problems with you people.
So one thing that came to mind immediately, something that like I liked and was really interested in and then very quickly grew to hate and then never stopped hating, was SCSI. Oh, SCSI, how you introduced me to a world of large hard drives that would say, I don't think I can see it. Or I think maybe I saved to it. Maybe I didn't. I don't know. I want a Terminator. I don't want a Terminator. I want to be fifth in the chain. I don't acknowledge the chain. So, oh, SCSI. It was supposed to be this amazing thing that I could have all these hard drives, and it never lived up to that. Like, just so disappointing. So SCSI, right away. Learn to hate it. Continue to hate it. Email, another thing. In two forms. Email for work, which is just a thing I have to deal with all the time. And it became an effort. So instead of being this joy of electronic communication, how fun, it becomes this thing where I'm trying to get other people to understand my tone or to read more than one question in my email. I'm going to send you four questions and you're going to answer the second one and I'm going to hate you. And so that's my experience with email and work now. But more I was thinking the word email and how I fought for so long. Here's the thing I hated and then just stopped hating. I fought for so long to not drop the hyphen in email. These are the hills that I've tried to die on. I was like, it's not a mail, it's email. Dear Lord, it needs a hyphen. And I lost that battle and I don't even spell it with a hyphen anymore. But that was the thing that I hated for the longest time. Everybody typing email, the word, without a hyphen. You think the GIF versus GIF thing. Boy, I was, for a lot of years, I was hot and heavy on that hyphen.
So I'm with you on the hyphen.
Now but I've just given up. I'm like, I just accept it is what it is. Printers has a bathtub curb for me. Early on, I got a printer. I was really excited about it. Like, look at me, I can print. The first printer I had was this little tiny thing for the one of the tandem, I think for the Model 1. And it was almost like a cassette tape came, or a cash register tape came out of it. It must have been 5 centimeters wide. It was like this tiny little thing. And it used these little pens to plot on it. And it was great. I could actually print things out. That was exciting. And then I got an Epson LX80. And I love that thing. For years and years, I had my LX80. It's sleek. It's cool. It's like, it looks like a Fiero, but it's a printer. And it was great. And I adored it. And then I entered 30 years of hating everything about printers. How they can never connect anything. They never want to see my network. Like, they're always a burden. And I was like, why aren't we going all digital? I hate buying these things. I'm buying ink for them and they've run out. Oh, now the toner is $9,000 and I can't see it. And I've got a fuser problem. And I'm like, oh my goodness. And trying to get various networks to see them. So I hated them for 30 years. And then recently, printers seem to have gotten good again. I got this weird brother, it's got a terrible name, like an ink vestment thing where you pour just ink into a bunch of pots and it just has a billion years with ink and it sees everything all the time and it works. And so I loved printers, and now I like printers again. So weird little bathtub shape. The brother one, which has a name like a MFC97324DWDJ. Funky Funk or whatever, like the worst names for these other things, is plugged into a box that's plugged into my computer because it's the printer at my office. So I have a FireWire 3 breakout box. It's plugged into that. Somebody a couple weeks ago came in my office when I wasn't there to print, needed to print something. So just had their laptop, unplugged the cable, plugged it into their printer. And of course, being a person I work with, just left the cable unplugged because why wouldn't they? I didn't notice for 2 weeks. I just went to print and the printer was like, yeah, I got you. And it just printed. I'm like, what do you mean just printed? Oh, I knew you meant this one. I just finds it over the net and just worked. I'm like, but the printer, it's unplugged. Oh, what? So printers once again are a thing I love. So that it went nice. Through hate and now I'm back on board with printers. So yay. And then another one that jumped to mind right away, might be a bit of a surprising one, is the Apple II. Because I'm kind of notoriously love the Apple II, and I do love the Apple II. And the Apple II was the first platform I really loved. But then I moved on to the Mac really early, and I love the Mac. And like most people, I abandoned my own love. And I was like, Apple II, it's like weird floppies, and it's so slow, and I didn't like the colors anymore. And now I've got these great-looking things. I got desktop publishing, and I got one mouse button, and that's all anybody needs. Yay! And I got seriously into the Mac, and I abandoned the Apple II forever. And then, 15 years ago or something like that, kind of refound my love for the Apple II. And then just, you know, like everybody goes back to something and became a complete zealot, because that's what one does. So the Apple II was something I didn't necessarily hate, but had kind of poo-pooed and left behind completely. And then just realized, as always, I was wrong, because that's the theme of today's show. I was wrong.
The wrongness of Carrington.
The wrongness of Carrington, except the hyphen in email. I was right about that. I just lost. So these are things that jump
I was pretty religious about capitalizing internet for a long
me
time.
Me too, right? Yes. It's a thing. It's a one thing. If you're going to make me capitalize South Dakota, you sure have to capitalize the internet, because there's no way that one is more important than the other. Come on.
Oh, I still do that. Yeah. I mean, I left the hyphen behind on email, but there's no way I will ever leave behind the capital internet.
Yeah, I still do. Because an internet is a thing, but the internet is the thing that we're talking about.
Yes. Well, how about not only capitalize, but drop the word the in front of it?
Oh, just internet.
Yeah, just internet.
I say the. Internet. I do say the. I guess I should just say internet.
Yeah.
It's like God, right?
It's not just God.
The God.
All capitalized.
No one talks about the God, the capital G God.
Well, you know, it's true. Before the internet, we would talk about internets from an internet working perspective.
Intranets and internets, yeah.
Routers, switches, you know, that kind of thing. I was in the networking world, and we use that terminology all the time. So there actually is a practical difference between the lowercase internet and the internet.
Right. And I would give two capital letters to FidoNet. And if I can do that, I can certainly give up one capital to internet. Come on.
I can press that shift key just one little
Absolutely. Time. Yeah, it's amazing how many people won't capitalize it. And I'll see, but you're capitalizing so many other things. Like, you're just basically shouting with all caps, and then you're just doing this on purpose. What do you do? Come on. I know your shift key you're works, because I see all these other things.
So the thing that I will always hate is copy protection.
Great choice.
From the
DRM, beginning, I can't believe I didn't pick that.
From the very beginning, just bugged the heck out of me. And probably for two reasons. One is that just my way of doing things, I've always been pretty, above board, straight down the line in terms of honoring the licenses of the software that I get. And so to me, copy protection was never any kind of helpful. It was only hurtful. It was like, I want to install it on this machine. Now I'm upgrading this machine. Uh-oh, I've somehow registered this, or it's done something to my hard drive to put itself on there so that if the hard drive fails, then all of a sudden, how do I reinstall the software? Or the floppy died because somebody came in my office and stuck it to the filing cabinet with a magnet. And now all of a sudden, I don't have that disk anymore because I couldn't make a backup of it. I loved, by the way, if I want to do the flip side of what I loved, Borland had a very no-nonsense license policy, and they actually, I think, called it a no-nonsense license policy, where they said, take the software and treat it like a book. You could take a book home with you. You could read it at home. You could take it to work. You could read it at work, but you wouldn't be reading it in both places at the same time unless you're omnipresent. So we're not going to put copy protection on this stuff, and we're going to trust that you're not going to give it to 50 of your closest friends. You're only going to use it in one place at one time. And I loved them for that. Unlike, one of the ones that I remember off the top of my head, Ashton Tate license agreements. You seriously had to be a lawyer. You probably had to be have a triple PhD in intellectual property law to read one of those license agreements. It just bugged the daylights out of me. So, copy protection. And I think even to this day, copy protection has dogged us because it's prevented the archival of a lot of computer history, or hasn't prevented it, but it certainly was a speed bump. And some people have found creative ways around it. So, didn't like copy protection.
Yep, strong agree.
Also, didn't like bad quality assurance. I got to say, I'm a Commodore fan, but one of the things I remember vividly from the 80s being in computer retail was bad QA on these mass-produced computers. And out of, five computers, maybe two or three of them would be defective right out of the box.
That is a high number.
Oh, it was horrible. And, we had to keep replenishing our stock, not so that we could sell more computers, but so that we could trade people out for the computers that they bought that were bad. I kind of took to start testing them out in the store before the person left. And it's like, no, you really don't have to do that. And I'm like, no, I really do. You don't want to go home and plug this in and have it not work. And trust me, there's a pretty high probability that that's what's going to happen. And it seems like even with cheap computers these days that QA has gotten so good, or maybe the technology just has become so mainstream that, I mean, you hardly ever take something out of a box and have it not work out of the box, right? When was the last time you guys remember getting a new product, like Amazon ships you something or whatever, you take it out and it's just broken straight away? I can't even remember the last time that happened to me.
Yeah, usually if something doesn't work, that's like the last thing I think. I figure I must be set. I must have set this
you
up
did it wrong. Yes, right.
Yep.
For me, at least 9 times out of 10, that is the case. I messed it up.
Yeah, exactly.
It's not broken. So.
Yeah, I think I had a Fire Stick, like a TV. You know, it's like a Chromecast kind of thing. That I was fairly convinced it didn't work for a while until I switched the cable. And it turned out it was actually the cable.
Mm.
That was the closest I came. But it was, you know, I remember marveling at, like, how could they have sent this to me and it didn't work? And I, you know, so it, I clearly didn't think that was even an option.
Right. Or are we through venting? That felt good.
Yeah, I think so.
Sure. I think there's actually, when we get to it, maybe we're about to be there, but there's a listener feedback that's kind of related to this too that we could tag on the end of it.
We are about to be there. I just want to weigh in on the coprocessor thing because I have a favorite coprocessor.
Oh, yes, that's right.
It's one of the
evergreen topics.
Evergreen host topics. Yes. Right. And my favorite of all time was the Intel Inboard 386. This was an ISA card that you would get for your PC. I think they had one for the AT, but I never had it for the AT. But I had a PC XT, and you slap this baby in, and suddenly it's a 386. And it's got the RAM on board. And the downside is, obviously, that you didn't get a 16-bit ISA bus with it, obviously. But since it had the RAM on the card itself, you didn't have any latency between the processor and the RAM. It was all one big full-size card. So when the PS2s came out, I'd had an XT, and then they gave me a Model 50, which was a 286 at, I can't remember if it was 8 or 10 megahertz. I just can't remember. But it was faster, and I liked it. And I was doing software development at the time, so faster was gooder. And I was able to do my compilers, you know, my compilations pretty quickly, cut down on the coffee breaks, unfortunately. But I like that, you know, pretty fast cycle of, you know, lather, rinse, repeat, code, test, break, fix. But it just didn't seem like as fast as it could possibly be. And so I asked my department, hey, give me back my old XT. And they're like, what's he doing? He's going backwards. I'm like, ah, but no. I'm going to get one of these inboard 386s. And we got one, and boom, man, I had like my little rocket PC. I was the fastest compiler on the block.
Nice.
Cool.
And plus, it worked really well, and the install was so easy. With a lot of coprocessors, you had this problem or that problem, you know, like daughter boards, or you didn't get the right drivers or something like that. But man, this board was easy. Just pop it in and suddenly Bob's your uncle. So that's my pick.
That's cool.
Very cool.
Yeah, it's funny because like my first reaction to that is kind of like it almost doesn't seem like a coprocessor in a sense because you're just kind of upgrading the brain, but it is, I mean, like functionally it's doing exactly the same thing. I mean, like it's, you know, you're running a different computer inside your one computer.
I mean, it's more like an accelerator, I guess. Well, maybe it's not even that. It used the other peripherals from your ISA bus. So in that sense, it's like an accelerator. It wasn't a coprocessor though. You're right. Because when you popped it in, the 8088 went nighty-night. So that's true. In that sense, it wasn't a coprocessor. Yeah.
Accelerators probably should fall in this category, really. Mm-hmm. I mean, it is. I think it is. There's something intriguing about the possibility, though, of running two things simultaneously, like having your, you know, Z80 on a card running a program while your 6502 on the motherboard is doing something as well.
Well, you mentioned listener feedback. Do we want to move to that?
Sure, we can do that. Yeah, so the thing I was thinking about was there's pretty recently on our Facebook page, Roger posted something which is kind of like a sort of like a philosophical post about, you know, his take on the various classifications of retro enthusiasts that there are. And so he sort of started off by hypothesizing that there's two types. One is like the game enthusiasts who find like the different kinds of retro games that you can get, you know, the ones that sort of differ from modern games. He finds them fun and, you know, varied and things like that. And then the second type is the type that are nostalgic of the back in the day experiences. And the second type, like period correct stuff and things like that. And so then in this post, Roger's putting forward this idea that he's the third type, which is, you know, he's happy that there's someone who's preserving the history, but his memory of computers was basically how frustrating their shortcomings were. And so he liked the fact that there was this like ZX Sinclair Next retro recreation, which is like, you know, super fast, but still like, you know, ZX based. And he said his fantasy retro computer would be a take on a Coco 3 that's connected to like a SID chip and a VIC-2 chip, but with VGA resolution graphics and hooked up to an HDMI display with 16 megabytes of RAM and, you know, solid stage storage and
a real mashup.
Yeah, but he said this is almost what the Mr. Coco would be.
Oh, interesting.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, so I mean, I thought that was kind of interesting. In one of the follow-up comments, David made posited a variant of the third type, which was that, you know, part of what this type of retro computing enthusiast enjoys is the kind of like showcasing the creativity that goes into working around the limitations. And I think that is actually a pretty important point. I mean, like, one of the things that's interesting about these limitations is that, you know, people did kind of amazing things with those.
Mm-hmm.
So, and you know, Roger kind of mentions that this might fall in with the kind of people who are into like the demo scene stuff, but I don't think that's entirely true. I mean, like, the demo scene is kind of about what kind of crazy things can you make this do beyond what you thought it could.
Right. Pushing the envelope, making it do things where somebody looks at it and goes, well, I didn't think you could do that.
Yeah. But even just in the practical stuff that's not demo, you know, pushing the graphics beyond what you think it could do. And then somebody else, Miguel Viz, followed up mentioning developers as well as another group that you know, developing sort of for a retro target, which is, that does seem like it's a slightly different group because at least what I've always kind of thought about this is that there's a lot of unexplored potential. Like these computers really did not last very long in the world because before they got superseded. And there's lots of stuff that we could have done that we never got around to. So, I mean, there's perfectly well things to develop for them now. So. It's sort of connected. Mm-hmm. It seems like it's sort of connected to what we were talking about.
It's all connected.
Let's see. So Rocky posted on our Facebook page to remind us of his papercraft design site now that we're all sort of stuck at home and might need little craft projects to do. And I also wanted to mention that he was recently interviewed as we are recording in the most recently posted episode of the Retro MacCast. He actually talked to them for a little while about how the projects got started and stuff like that. So
that is a good idea. That's something that you can do. It doesn't take a whole ton of time, but it's entertaining. And what you come out with is some pretty fun little replica paper craft.
Yeah, they look fantastic too.
Yeah, they really do. So, like they're fantastic looking.
I think we've mentioned
a few
of them along the way. But, you know, he's got, I forget now what he said, but it's like 30 something different models you can make. So, and actually, you know, on Facebook, we've had a number of people posting their podcast episodes, which is good. Lots of podcasts to listen to as you're commuting to work. So, but Floppy Days has continued to run through the computers. He's working on the BBC Micro now and recently did some Epson ones. I don't know, Earl, did you help out with any of the Epson ones or not?
I did. The HX20 episodes I helped out with. That was fun. Yeah. Always like recording with Randy.
Coco Crew continues. John posted something about that.
It's funny with podcasts, everyone being home, all the podcasters have so much more time to podcast, but nobody's commuting, so nobody has any time to listen. I know so many people say they're so far behind on their podcast listening.
Yeah,
that's true, without the commute. Although I've also noticed that a lot of the retro YouTubers have been putting out more frequent videos, and I have had time to see those, and some of those have just been fantastic. So thank you to our YouTube counterparts because, you know, great entertainment, learned a bunch of stuff.
I think our listeners who normally listen to us on a commute should just sit in a chair and imagine for 45 minutes that they're driving to work, and they should simply have to do that. They just sit silently in the chair with headphones on and their hand up like they're driving, and I think they owe us that.
They could even play like they're going through the Starbucks drive-thru. Hang on, I have to pause the podcast for just a second.
Exactly.
Yeah, see, you went a different way with that. I was thinking about like shouting and gesturing at neighboring motorists. But that's okay. It tells us each a little bit about ourselves, I guess.
It doesn't.
I'm driving here. I'm driving here.
Let's see. So Brian on Facebook reminded us of, I don't know if it was intentional that he reminded us of this, but he posted an auction for the Spartan by Mimic Systems, which is basically an Apple II that you can plug in the back of your Commodore.
Yeah, it's not really an emulator. It is an Apple II that you plug into your Commodore.
Yeah. And I think it was the last time, we couldn't remember the name of this thing, but this is it. It's the Spartan. Basically I think the thing that's cool about it is that I've never seen, it's super complete. I mean, like it's in the box, it's got the warranty card.
On eBay, this was like a whole complete one with the box. I've never seen this before. Would have been a great eBay pick.
What'd it go for?
Almost $1,200. Yeah.
Ooh.
$1,183, wow. 79 bids. It did not go cheap. Into that good night.
But it's cool. So anyway, if you wanted to see what this really kind of looked like, I guess there's a little tape on the box. But I mean, otherwise, this is unbelievable. Yeah, it's something like a coprocessor. I mean, it's basically using your Commodore as a keyboard for your Apple II.
My favorite coprocessors now that we've been talking about this topic for a few episodes, is this idea that you can take one whole computer and put it inside another computer, particularly the ones where it's like, let's put a more powerful computer inside your old computer. I just adore that. I adore that whole idea that this one computer will be a host for an even better one. I love that. I mean, that's not the case necessarily here, but those ones that we've mentioned, I just adore that.
Yeah. Okay. Anything? Well, actually, I think that's basically the end of the feedback that I was going
to
mention.
We got a comment right now about the podcasts. Oh. Roland says he likes to listen while doing the dishes. That's actually what I do some podcast listening also.
I do the same thing, weirdly. I wonder how many people do that. I absolutely listen to podcasts while I do dishes.
Yep, doing dishes and cooking.
Yep.
On a podcast.
Yeah, 100%. I am a kitchen podcast listener. It's the acoustics, man.
That'll help people catch up. So that's a great tip. Carrington, you have the first item of interest.
I do. Okay, then I shall share a screen and tell you all about it. The Mini VMac, you probably have heard of it if you're listening to the show. It's an emulator for classic Mac stuff. If you want to run Mac System 6 or System 7 things, imagine you want to pretend your computer is a Mac Plus. Mini VMac is a great way to do it. Somebody has ported that to the Nintendo DS. I think that's amazing. Anyway, the 2DS and the 3DS, so the latest ones of those, it has been ported to that. We have a link here to a couple of write-ups, but I've brought up on screen here the Mac Rumors write-up, which shows a nice image of it running on a 2DS, the keyboard down on the bottom screen, and the top shows the About This Macintosh image. That's pretty amazing. It's just
nice.
Crazy. So it's been ported, runs fine. This is actually the second version of it, but it's the first version I had heard of. I think this is amazing. I think this is crazy. I think this is almost certainly unusable, but like whatever. A bunch of people there's a video on the Mac Rumor site that we're going to link to. Also, we're going to link to the actual GitHub. So if you want to do this yourself, our first link will be to the GitHub repository. But this nice write-up on Mac Rumors, and I'm linking to that one because there's a video on that, so you can watch a video of it actually running. And then that's pretty amazing. A bunch of people have posted images online of running HyperCard, of running games. Comments in general are, this does not run fast. Not quite as fast, I think, as an original Mac Plus. It runs incredible. So they say if you try to launch something and all you get is a black screen, don't think it crashed. Just wait quite some time and eventually it will come up. So it's more of a proof of concept than anything else, but I applaud it. This is amazing. And what a feat of ingenuity to get this done. So Mini VMac, you can now use your 2DS or 3DS to run old classic Macintosh software, and I adore it.
I wonder if there's any kind of a hack or something that you have to do to sideload applications on those platforms. I remember with some of the older of the Nintendo handhelds that my kids had that, you couldn't just run them. You had to do something special.
I don't know.
Could be. I don't know.
Nice.
Yep. So that's what we got.
Very nice.
I got the next thing, and I blatantly stole it from Blake. Thank you, Blake, who couldn't be here. And so I take your news. Ha ha. This is a video. It's more than 30 minutes, I think. It is a really well done video. I like it. It's on computer land and on a computer called the BC88. So this video actually is an amalgam of two different things. One is a well-researched and well-articulated history of computer land. Where did they come from? How did they do? Where did they go? It has a lot of the usual drama that you can expect with a business, especially some of the computer businesses of the 70s and 80s. Those things were just, for whatever reason, they were laden with drama. And this is no exception. And that's always interesting to me, the people aspect of it, the business aspect of it. If you read the book Fire in the Valley, you find that as well as the technology being interesting, one of the, I would say in some ways, even more interesting aspects of the early computer world were the various personalities involved and the sometimes smart and sometimes catastrophically stupid decisions that they made, which is why a lot of them aren't around anymore, including computer land. So videos worth watching for that. Secondly, this computer, the BC88, was a computer land branded computer. And it's pretty fascinating in that it's a PC clone, but it doesn't have a motherboard per se. It has a passive backplane. And I'd seen one or two other systems like this back in the 80s that the processor card is actually on its own card. And the thought was, in the future, if you want to upgrade it, you don't have to throw the whole computer away. You just pop out the processor card, pop in a new, more powerful processor, and you're off and running. And as the creator of this video points out, that sounds good on paper, but in reality, by the time a processor generation happened back then, which was about a 3 to 4 year time cycle, so much of the other technology had also improved, whether it was the video or the chipset or the storage or things like that, that you're probably just going to throw the thing out and get a new computer anyway. So sounds nice, but oh well. And it didn't save computer land, as he points out, was targeted toward corporate America. And a lot of things at computer land in the 80s were targeted more toward corporate buyers, I recall. Just old man rambling here. When I worked in computer retail, well, that's actually most of what I do. I worked in computer row. I mean, within a couple miles radius, there were a bunch of different computer stores in Southern California. And Computerland was one of them. And I always kind of envied how nice they looked. I mean, if you walked into the computer store I worked at first, the first one, it was okay. I mean, we had some glass shelves. We had a bunch of different things, random things that were kind of thrown together, like Seiko watches and Speak and Spell and then an Apple II and TI calculators. You didn't really get any kind of a coherent feel. But if you walked into a computer land, you saw nice furniture. You saw systems that were set up and well merchandised. You just felt like, ooh, this, you know, this has a nice professional feel. Later on, I worked at a small computer chain that had that same kind of feel, and it was nice. We had the, you guys remember, was it the O'Sullivan furniture back then? From the 80s? Seems like that was the company that made all the desks and things.
Oh, I don't know that. No. I mean, I wouldn't know, though.
Well, we had their furniture nicely set up. We had plenty of space. We had nice demo areas. And there was something to be said for a computer store that you could walk in and it felt approachable. Hmm. You know, it didn't felt like a tube of electronics had blown up. And you know,
or could at any minute.
Right. Where you were at risk of that. Just something that felt like a more professional environment. That's what Computerland always seemed like to me. But that had overhead, and the overhead resulted in more cost, and more cost resulted in not being competitive, and a bunch of other drama happened. But I won't spoil any more of the video than I already have. Go watch it, because I loved it.
Does the video talk about whatever happened to the guy who founded and ran it? What was his name?
It
William
did.
Something. William, because he,
yep.
William H. Like, Millard.
That was it. Like, I mean, because I remember a bunch of years ago, he popped up in the news again saying, okay, he's been missing for like a decade. He owes $100 million in tax. He's been found in the Grand Caymans. There's like 100 different bank accounts and companies are hiding the money, like some big thing. And then I just never heard what came of that. So
if you want to know that, you can know that. You just have to watch the end of this video because he actually covers that.
Oh, excellent. Mm-hmm. I am quite keen because it was a whole big drama, I remember. I was like, what? Because he invented the IMSI or funded it or something?
It was related to IMSI.
It was. I thought it was confusing it with someone else. Okay, cool.
Yep.
Nice.
All right. So, Jack, you've got the next thing up. Al Alcorn.
Yeah, I just found this neat article on the IEEE Spectrum website. Al Alcorn, that has one of these catchy titles. Al Alcorn, creator of Pong, explains how early home computers owe their color graphics to this one cheap, sleazy trick.
You won't believe number seven.
So basically, it's kind of an interesting set of anecdotes. Looks like they were interviewing Al Alcorn, and he was talking about, so he taught WAS this trick for generating color using NTSC aliasing for the Apple II, and he explains where he learned it, and he was doing TV repairs when he was younger, and there was a color bar generator that worked by having a crystal that was somehow shifted from the normal scan frequency of like this thing drawing the beam. And so what the effect was that going down the screen, you would end up with color bars. So it was a pretty cheap piece of hardware, but it had the effect of doing this. So it's kind of a neat article. There's not like a lot of pictures here going on, but it's just, I always enjoy the kind of anecdotes when they're talking about, you know, someone who was there talking about where this came from and here are the kind of conversations that we had about this and that sort of thing. And one of the points that they make in there also is that we've gone so much over to digital electronics that there almost are no people doing analog electronics work along the kind of things that he was doing back in the early part of his career. And that he kind of bemoans that a bit, saying that there are problems that still could be solved with analog electronics that aren't being solved that way today.
Hmm.
So anyway, it's a fun, quick read that I wanted to mention.
Cool.
Yeah. And the title does catch your attention, you know, yes. I mean, as it's supposed to do.
Well, that's, and the funny, cheap, sleazy trick actually resulted in these days interfering, I think, with the Apple II being used on some modern flat screen monitors, right? Like, yep, you have to have one that will properly interpret that NTSC wizardry.
Mm. Yeah. Makes sense. Yeah. I think one of the things he mentioned in the article was someone was trying to record a video of something for a television broadcast, trying to record the Apple II maybe, or trying to record Pong. I forget what it was. And the technician was saying, we can't record this. This won't record on our videotape. It doesn't turn out right. And so he kind of gave them a hint, telling them what they had to do, like basically pretend it was a PAL system because he had somehow disabled interlacing or something. Just like the weird trick that he had done that on the display, it looks fine, but it meant that you couldn't actually record onto a videotape at the time. So interesting. And I don't even really exactly understand it, but it's like, it's just interesting.
Yeah, I think it sort of approximated the NTSC standard well enough that it would fool the televisions into working, basically.
Right. It's close enough to make a TV work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Paul, what's RetroFair 2020?
So RetroFair 2020, I came across this only recently. I'm assuming that it had been around, you know, like this page had been around for a while. But essentially this was, at least the reason I came to know about it was that VCF West, I think, got canceled, or maybe it was Pacific Northwest, one of them.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, they all got canceled, but I think this was sort of in response to that, people basically putting up presentations that they would have done at the event, you know.
Oh.
So last time we talked a little bit about, you know, how to maybe handle virtual events and things like that. This, I think, came up so suddenly that they weren't really able to deal with it. But so I guess, yeah, VCF Pacific Northwest is generally what this is. So it's just a bunch of people's videos talking about the projects that they would have wanted to present at this. And it's actually kind of a lot.
Yep.
Cool.
I have not actually looked at this very carefully, but so some things, you know, history things, stuff about the BBC Micro, 3D printing a little cray, you know, it's all kinds of stuff.
And they've made it really easy for people to contribute by basically just having a hashtag, and you create your thing and include that hashtag, and bingo, you've entered yourself to be eligible to be put up here. It's, they really made it streamlined. I think that's why so many people are able to participate, because they took all the layers of difficulty away from that.
Yeah.
But there's a ton, and it keeps growing. When I first looked at this, there were fewer than half that number of videos. And so in the last week, a bunch have been added.
Yeah, this is, I'm pretty impressed, actually. I mean, like, if you're, you know, for whatever reason, bored at home, there's a lot of stuff here, and it's new, you know, so you won't have seen it before. So I think it's definitely worth checking out. So I wanted to be sure that this was kind of just made known.
And it's also bite-sized, because they indicate in the instructions here, keep it to 5 minutes or less. Which would pretty much disqualify any RCR member.
Yes.
But that is, so you can just watch a video, you know.
Some of the videos are definitely longer than that. I've watched a few and they 100% were much longer than that.
Oh, okay.
So they might say that, but I'm like, none of the ones I watched so far do that. I watched one that went on a long time, too long, and I skipped it. But it's still a really cool thing that this exists.
I tend to like long form videos, but I know some people are kind of hyper.
So you're the reason our shows are all 2 hours long. Aha!
I'll take that hit.
At Kansas Fest, a couple of times we've had little sessions where they're lightning talks. You know, so it's basically essentially like the design is you have some little thing to say. You know, it's not going to take long to do. It's if it's a disaster, it's going to be over in 5 minutes. So who cares?
I loved the lightning talks. I think. Yeah. It definitely, the last time I was at Kansas Fest, which I think was the first time that happened, so it had been like 2 Kansas Fests ago, and it was great. It was one of my favorite sessions, because you got a lot of people have something to present, and it's not a whole half an hour's worth of things, or they would just stretch it out to be half an hour, so instead you get 5 minutes of it or whatever, and it was great, like bang, 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 all of them really interesting.
Yeah, so I think this kind of like short form thing could well work pretty nicely for, you know, if you don't want to commit a whole bunch of time to watching someone fix their, you know, Apple IIe or whatever, you can still sort of see the steps and know if that's something you want to explore more later.
Well, flipping it, it also might get more people to contribute, because for a 5 minute video, if you produce it well, it takes a heck of a lot more than 5 minutes, right? You know, with all the editing and yada, yada. So
but you also don't have to feel like you've got to come up with an hour's worth of material.
Right.
To be, you know, worthy of presenting on this. You can say, no, I got one cool, neat thing. Just let me show you this one thing I own or one thing I've done or whatever. You can just hold a box up to
this one cheap, sleazy trick.
Yes. Let me show you my cheap, sleazy trick.
All right. Well,
check that out.
Next, I thought we were done with the hate, but now we're scapegoating COBOL.
No, this isn't hate. This is love.
It's not even here to defend itself.
It doesn't need to, because Mar Hicks, who is brilliant, and if you don't follow Mar Hicks on Twitter, you should. She's a tech historian, and she's brilliant. She's so brilliant. And a couple times a month, she'll tweet something and go, and I'll read it and think, I have now changed my mind about something I thought I knew for 20 years. Like, she's just can so succinctly put something just so well and tell me how wrong I am so quickly. It's great. I love it. She's improved me as a person. So Mar Hicks did a quick little video that's kind of blowing up. That's 50 minutes. So too long for the thing we just talked about. So too bad, Mar, you're out. And it's about scapegoating, the current scapegoating of COBOL. COBOL's back in the news. We talked about it, I think, last episode, but how a bunch of, you know, everybody kind of knows the cliche is all the banks run on COBOL, but also a lot of the systems where people are applying to unemployment insurance or employment insurance, depending on which country you're in, as they want to call it different things. Those systems weren't kind of necessarily designed to have so many people at once go, pandemic, give me money. And so they're crashing, and there's starting to be some blame, as often happens. You blame the technology. Oh, these old systems can't keep up. Old is bad. It's COBOL. COBOL is bad. This whole thing should have been done in JavaScript or whatever. So that's what people are saying. And so Mar Hicks, being brilliant, says, well, let's look at that, and let's look at these systems, and they're just using COBOL as a scapegoat, and that is not what caused this. These are systems that the problem is the people who are meant to be running them and meant to be doing the upkeep were all laid off or fired years ago. Because the systems are so robust and run so well, it becomes an excuse to get rid of that department. Like, we don't need those people. They don't do anything. But then suddenly when they're needed, well, we fired them 5 years ago and then no one knows how to program it. Really, really interesting little video. 50 minutes kind of looking at that, looking at what COBOL is, what COBOL stands for, what COBOL's design was. Like, she starts right at the beginning of COBOL, talks about its goal as a language, who are the main players behind the design of that language, how was it implemented, and right up to the modern day of how it's getting scapegoated for failing EI systems. And she does this in 15 minutes. It's amazing. It's a awesome tour de force. It's great. And at the end, she kind of jokes, or I think either on Twitter or on the end of this, she jokes that, hey, that a lot of people are interested. Maybe I should do a bunch of 15-minute videos about operating systems and programming languages. And I'm like, oh, dear Lord, please. Like, it would be so good. So this is a video I highly recommend. It's 15 minutes, and I came out of it knowing so much more about COBOL than I knew going in. Is great. So have any of you guys watched this? Or was 15 minutes too much to ask?
I haven't watched it, but I definitely will. I didn't know about it.
I'm hoping
I thought the current discussion about COBOL in the past month or whatever has been interesting, just because it sort of dredges up this topic again. And I was on a hangout talking with a bunch of other Swift developers, and this came up, and somebody was like, oh, well, you know, how long do you think COBOL is still going to be around? Like 5 or 10 years? And I was like, no. Like 50 years, 100 years, like COBOL is going to outlive all of us. it's in everything. And that doesn't mean it's wrong. Just like CPUs are in everything.
Right.
Like there is so much software built in COBOL that is fundamental to the operation of the world and it doesn't make any sense to remove it.
And the funny thing that I didn't know, like I've talked about COBOL on the show a lot, and everybody knows there's very little that I actually know. And so I think of COBOL as this 1960s language that all the banks used. And it's just like, oh, it's this old thing. It's like predates everything. They banged the rocks together and they made this thing, the common business oriented language. The 2002 version of COBOL is the object oriented version. Like it's been a living language that has been updated in new versions. Right. Like, to this day, I was like, really? I thought it was like ANSI C and it just stayed that way. No, it's a living, evolving language. And the version everyone's using now is based on, but very different than what came out in the late 60s. And anyway, Mar teaches us all is what I'm saying.
Awesome. Very cool.
Yeah. I've got a couple of other really quick things as well to shoehorn in because I had too much news to only give me two things. So I'll quickly switch this over to talk about a really nice article written by Ben Edwards. If he writes a thing, it's always worth seeing. It's over on How to Geek, and it's about why he still uses an IBM Model M keyboard. That's the famous keyboard. Everybody loves them, the clicky-clacky keyboard. And this discusses the keyboard, and I've got one. I've got two of them, and I adore it. But it's a nice article because it talks about, like, why does he use it? It's, you know, a lot of people use these things because, like, you want to be a hipster and you want to use an old keyboard. But he talks about, like, legitimately, why does he use this keyboard? And yes, you like the feel of it, but there's some other things about it that, like, it stays in place. You can bang away on it or whatever, and it's designed to not move around on your keyboard. And just like that kind of stuff, like, just the realities of using it and why he enjoys it, but also, like, what is his reasoning for using a 30-year-old keyboard? And Ben writes great. So it's one of those things where it's not a difficult read. You can go through it really quickly, and it's great. Makes a lot of really good points about why would one want to use ones. So quick question for you guys. Any of you still use old keyboards? And if you have an old keyboard in front of you right now?
I don't. But
clack for yes.
But however, I will say that if you don't want to go through the effort that it takes to use one of the old keyboards, that these days you can still get very good quality keyboards with good, you know, the key mechanisms and that kind of thing from Cherry, like the Cherry MX key switches are amazing. And they're available in a variety of choices. So you can either have the ones that click or the ones that don't click. You can have ones that have less force required for a key press and ones that have more force required for a key press if that's the particular style of typist that you are. And the one that I have is a Corsair, and it has a very heavy metal plate. So what you said he was mentioning in the article about the keyboards not flying around on your desk while you're trying to use it, that's extremely annoying to have your keyboard moving around. Right? It's like it's running away from you. And mine doesn't do that. So If you want the style of an old keyboard, some of the advantages, but you don't want to actually go through the effort of finding and adapting an old keyboard, there are other choices for you. But I fully support using an old Model M because, man, those things were built like tanks, still work great to this day. And I guess I'd use one if I could.
Same. I also would. If I had one, I would use it.
I'm not allowed to use one at work because normally I'm not there by myself and everybody gets annoyed at my clacky keyboards.
Well, now's your chance while you're there.
I do.
And the thing clacking away, echoing around that whole space.
Yep. Just me and my echoes, man. I love my echoes. 100%. Like at work now, I am using a Model M. I have Model M with a little USB adapter thing and that's what I use. So I dig it.
Awesome.
I like it very much. I find it's one of those things where it's that like you hate it, you love it. And my little, you know, bathtub things. Like I took a long time to move over to small travel keyboards. Like I was a advocate of the big clack. Got to have lots of motion, lots of clack. It should be a workout. Your fingers should hurt at the end of the day. So like you should have to push really far. I want full arm movement. and then I migrated over to more modern keyboards and use the keyboards on laptops and modern Apple keyboards. And they're really nice. Like I actually will not the last one I got on my 15-inch, that terrible new keyboard. That was awful. But I became a convert to smaller keyboards and really liked them. And then it was kind of hard for me to go back to a big clacky keyboard because it would actually tire me out. Like it was hard to have so much key motion. It became more difficult to type quick on. And in the same way that when I moved over to smaller keyboards or flatter keyboards rather, it was difficult for me to type on those because I felt like I was just banging my fingers on a board. Like it felt like you're just typing on your desk directly. And it's like, I'm going to bruise my fingers. Things aren't moving enough. So it's funny how it's more about what you get used to. But it's still the case that there's something lovely about just like sitting there and just hearing, you feel like you're doing something. I'm looking at me, I'm productive.
I'm tweeting
like a madman. So I don't know. Earl, so you've got one of these fancy newfangled things. Mm-hmm. Are you a particular key switch guy? Are you I'm a cherry red, a cherry blue, a cherry black, and a cherry other colors. I don't really know what I'm talking about.
Well, the one that I have now is an MX Red, and okay. It was inherited from my son, who
got one of the... And that's what all the gamers use, right? The gamers love the red ones.
That's right. They like the red because they don't...
Pro gamer.
They don't want the clack.
Right.
You know, the red...
So you sneak up on people.
The red has the nice actuation pressure. It has nice smooth movement, but it doesn't have a click.
And you can play stealth games with.
I have to admit, I miss that. I would rather have one of the other MX flavors... You know, rather than the red, because I like the audible click and that feel, but I don't have that now. But still, the MX Red is a very nice key switch. I got to say, I type on that thing all day. And when I've talked to other business people, like if you want to have a better just life experience, you're on your computer 8 hours a day, get a gaming keyboard. Get one with a cherry key switch that matches your taste. And they're like, a gaming keyboard? I don't need something like that. I'm like, no, you do. This is a life changer. You know, you're not talking that much more money than just one of the El Cheapo throwaway keyboards, but it's a game changer for you. You know, you sit there. Also, a gaming mouse, I find, is a really good investment. You know, you're thinking, I'm not gaming. I don't need to be, you know, spamming the clicks. That's not the point.
You're spamming your clicks, man.
Yeah. The point is the feel in your hand, the weight, the precision. You know, you don't notice it until you get one. Now I'm spoiled. Now I could never go back. If you give me a cheapo keyboard and mouse, I'd be done.
It always seems like these things have about like three times as many buttons as you have fingers.
So I have a gaming mouse that I use that has two normal buttons and the wheel is a third button. And then it has two thumb buttons on the side. And that's about it. So it doesn't have a ton of extras. Or it has one little extra button here that I think that just changes sensitivity. So you can switch between low and high sensitivity on the fly, kind of.
So it's got two thumb buttons for your two thumbs.
Yes, for my two thumbs. That's
a great design. really thought that one through.
For my thumb tip and my thumb butt.
Oh, ooh,
what is that part of the thumb? That's the tip. That's the waist. I don't know.
Yes, it's your thumb waist, where you put your waistcoat. Cool. Okay, so I have one other quick one. Tweeting from a teletype. I don't know if you guys have done this, but I want to do this. I want to do this very badly. And this is a great video about somebody who's got a bunch of teletypes and tweets from them. There's also a couple of Twitter accounts you can follow that are just from their from teletypes, so like this particular teletype now tweeting. But this video is terrific. So 17, 18 minutes long, something like that. And it shows a whole bunch of teletypes and tweeting from them. And it's just a joy. It's the dream, man. This is the dream. So tweeting from a teletype, it brings it all together. And I watched it like 3 times. So we'll have a link to this in the show notes if you want to be like me.
I wish I had an ASR33. They're just so beautiful.
Oh, my life would be better if I came home and to the left, you throw your keys to the left, you look to the right, and it's like, oh yeah, look at that baby. Life would be complete.
You know, I guess I shouldn't admit that I used one for real back in the day, but part of the reason isn't just the expense of getting one, which they weigh about 1 million pounds, I think approximately 1 million pounds, but it's also the upkeep because, you know, you have to use exponential notation to count the springs inside one of these suckers. And in terms of if you're not an expert at dealing with one, I think it's just scary to me. It'd be scary to have one that would break and I'd just be sitting there scratching my head. But man, I'd love to have one.
This is the kind of thing where I think I want them as much for the aesthetics as the reality. Like I would do the hipster thing. If somebody came out with a new, a modern version of these that from the outside looked like a traditional teletype, but on the inside was just like a regular printer that just was easy to work with, a brother weird name one or something like that. I would absolutely just sweep it up. I'd be like, I don't care if you judge me. It's bringing me joy and I don't have to fix it every day.
It's a product idea. You heard it here, folks.
Yes. Earl's going to make it. Anyway, that's what I got. 3 quick ones.
Cool. All Carrington, right. Roland had a question in the chat. Is that Curious Mark? He wants to know.
Oh, I don't know. I don't know who was doing it.
He does a lot of teletype stuff.
Yes, it is.
Yes.
Well spotted. Okay. This is not a person I knew. I just came across the video. So it is indeed Curious Mark. I watched this video 3 times, but didn't even think to look, does this person have other videos? Oh, look, they've got a bunch of videos. I am not apparently Curious Carrington.
You should check out the series that Curious Mark has that they did. There were a lot of installments on fixing, refurbishing the Apple guidance computer. It was amazing.
Nice.
And by that, you mean Apollo guidance computer?
Yeah, sure.
What did I call it?
The Apple guidance Apple computer.
No, not the Apple guidance computer. No, there was no such thing.
That's more obscure computer.
Yes, indeed. It sat in a room and Jobs would ask it questions every now and then. Yeah. No.
Well, it would just keep overheating because it didn't have a fan.
Thank you. Yep.
It was one of the few teletypes with just one key. All that we need is just one key. And depending on how hard you press it, it does a different character.
Will we succeed? It's just a yes key.
Yeah.
Somewhere there was kind of like a, some funny mock-up of, I think it was like a click wheel, like MacBook Pro or whatever.
Something that I loved. There's another one that I didn't like after, like a later hate thing. When they moved from the mechanical click wheel on the early iPods to the faked click wheel, like the one that's more like the way we do things now, that's the touch wheel or whatever. Mm. That was a very disappointing change. Mm. The equivalent to me is when they dropped the MagSafe stuff on, like some things where I'm like, why did you do this? This is a terrible choice.
Yep.
Yeah, those were great connectors.
Wheel all the way. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. MagSafe was genius.
Yeah. Genius.
By the way,
anyway, who's next?
I found the thing, and it's an Onion video that says Apple introduces revolutionary new laptop with no keyboard.
Awesome.
So maybe perhaps we'll link to that. I don't know.
I hope we do.
Paul, you have the next thing. I don't think I even understand this, so you got to talk about it.
Okay, so last time we talked a little bit about this. I sort of stumbled through talking about this Sphinx, a 30-year-old Soviet smart home concept computer.
It remains gorgeous.
Yeah, I won't re-talk about it. But one thing that showed up in one of the articles about it, so I guess this was in the in exhibit one, was this picture of a parade in Berlin in 1987 showing one of the very few original PCs ever produced in a socialist state, the VEB Robotron PC 1715. And I forgot to comment about that photo, but I thought it was kind of interesting. There's a possibly a colorized version of it I'm not sure if it may originally be black and white, but this is a color rendition of it that, you know, shows it's pretty hilarious. There's just like, it's a parade of people, you know, with these little wagons that have PCs on them that sort of demonstrating the like technical advancedness of.
But it's like somebody went for a walk with their computer. Come on, Sparky, let's go for a walk. Just to get in the cart and just walking around the block. That's bizarre.
So it's Volkswagener Betrieb, I think, is what this is. The publicly owned corporation, Robotron PC 1715. And there was even there's a stamp that it appeared on in East Germany.
You mean like a postage kind of a big stamp?
Thing. Yeah.
Like a commemorative?
10 Pfennig.
Wow.
But so anyway, I didn't know anything about the Robotron PC 1715 before, but I thought it was kind of funny that there was this picture of it in a parade. So and I failed to mention it last time, so I wanted to just bring that back. I think that's basically all I had on that. But
cool. Well, Carrington, you have the next thing, and once again, you have a Commodore news item. So I feel like we're winning you over.
Kind of not with this one, but we'll get there. So this is a really neat thing called primary optics, and it's by a fellow named Robert Hanke. So German, I think, and he created an audio-visual presentation that uses a bunch of, I think, 5 or 6 Commodore CBM machines to create a display. Like, you sit in an audience and it shows these flashing lights on screen, all in green and linked together, and it's his music. And it's the kind of thing where I don't like the results, but I like what happened. Well, because it's not for me. Like, not everything's about me, right? So this is this really brilliant dude who linked these together and use it to make art. Like, it creates music, it creates these visuals that go with it, and it's like an interesting thing. But if you were in the audience for this, I think it would give me an epileptic seizure, because it's this massive screen just flashing green stuff very brightly and playing electronic music very loudly. And I don't dig that kind of music, right? So that's because, like, I'm not the target audience. Like, somebody could make like a really amazing movie in a genre I don't like, and I'm not fit to criticize it because I don't like the genre. Like, it's, I don't know if it's any good, and I don't like electronic music. So what this person created wasn't really for me, but it was still an interesting thing. So first I was going to bring it up just for that. Like, it's neat that somebody did this recently. Like, this isn't something he did back in the 80s. He took computers that were already decades old and said, I'm going to make art with these and do something interesting. And so a bunch of people came to the presentation, and it's up on a big screen. And so he's got these Commodore CBM machines linked together, playing music, all synchronized, and doing this video display, all created on those machines. And so that was really cool. I thought, like, that's a neat thing. Who is this guy? Well, it turns out he is a really fascinating fellow. So this Robert Hanke gave the keynote address to the Loop 2015 convention, and he did an amazing address called Failure is Equals Success, about this notion of making things that are computerized, whether it's art or just programs or whatever, and how failure is the thing you're doing when you're looking forward, and success denotes the moment where you just start looking backwards. Like, failure, you are not creating things if you are not failing. It was this whole other way to look at programming, another way to look at creating art, including on retro things. And I thought it was just fascinating. Like, he's such an interesting guy. So it's this weird thing where sometimes somebody will make art that I love, but then they personally will do something where I think, oh, you're a monster. I don't want to promote your book. Turns out maybe I don't want to talk about this because you're not a good person. I happen to like the thing you made. This is kind of the opposite. This guy seems brilliant, and I'm like, become a fanboy of somebody who makes things where I'm like, I don't actually want to watch your art, but I do want to listen to you talk about your art. Brilliant, insightful fellow, making really different things using Commodores in a modern time. So what an interesting dude. So I want to link both to the display, because if you like electronic music, this might be something, because it's not just a presentation that shows the art. It's a presentation about this artwork. So half of this video is interviews with him and with other people talking about the process he went through to create this. So even if you're just interested in how would one create music and visual art using old computers and network them together and use a projector and what have you, it talks about the process he went through. And then we'll also have a link to his keynote speech from 4 or 5 years ago about failure and success and a different way to think about those when you're programming or making artwork that I thought was really insightful and like really interesting dude. Hadn't heard about him before, but I became an instant fan.
Nice.
That's what I got.
Very cool. Sounds cool.
Yeah.
Well, I guess the next thing we have on our lineup is the upcoming show roundup, which obviously has...
But there is news when it comes to that.
There's quite a few news items here, actually. So the last Chicago Cocoa Fest has been postponed until further notice. Was going to happen, looks like, a couple weeks ago. Didn't happen, obviously. The VCF East has new dates. So they're shooting for October 10th through the 12th of 2020. And there'll be information in the link that we'll have in the show notes. Kansas Fest is big news. Kansas Fest switched to a virtual conference this year. I think first time ever, right, that Kansas Fest will be all virtual. And the registration's now open, opened up recently within the last few days. Paul, you could probably speak to this better. I signed up straight away. I'm actually excited that I can quote unquote go to one.
Yeah, no, I think it's registration is humming right along, like at an unbelievable clip.
Is it a worrisome clip? Do you guys have worries about limitations?
Yeah, capacity.
Oh, I think we'll handle it. I think that, you know, I think
big words from Paul there.
We'll try to make sure that it's a fun thing for everybody to do.
Cool.
Because I mean, in one sense, this is also people's chance to decide whether they want to make the trek next year, right? I mean, so.
Mm-hmm.
But also, the shirt is very cool. It's sort of like a dial-up screen that's attempting to connect to Kansas Fest 2020 and then switching to remote.
Yep. Yeah, it's a really good concept for the shirt.
It is cool. I bought the shirt.
Yeah, nice.
Been there.
I did not, because I just go shirtless.
Have the t-shirt.
But maybe I'll also put this in that usually every year there is a WASFest, sort of simultaneous Australian event to Kansas Fest. And this year's WASFest Sweet 16 is announced for Saturday, July 25th, 2020, starting at midday Sydney time. And it also is going to be a virtual event. So if you... And I think for the most part, they're not going to overlap in time. So when Kansas Fest shuts down and you're still full of retro energy or stimulants or something.
Keep the stream going.
Then you can.
But don't cross the streams.
Yeah. But I mean, I think, you know, one thing that's maybe more important than usual, even on this, is that a lot of these events, you know, so Kansas Fest is the one I'm thinking about. But I mean, like any virtual event is likely to have people in a lot of different time zones, you know, so we have an interesting challenge trying to schedule our recordings, you know, because we ask Michael to get up at like 6 a.m. or whatever to do these recordings. But you know, so when we have a kind of like a global event like this, there's going to be people for whom it's just not convenient to be at some of these things. So WASFest kind of takes care of that other half of the globe.
I hadn't really thought of that. So you're on the Kansas Fest committee, and I'm not mentioning the fact that Kansas Fest many, many, many years ran fine, and then you got on the committee, and suddenly the thing can't even take place. It's like, I'm just saying. okay. anyway, I had thought of that. So is the thinking that Kansas Fest will take place during the hours that Kansas Fest normally would? Like, these are Kansas times, figure it out. Or is it going to be spread all over?
Well, I think
commit to an answer, Paul.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I've been working with another sort of an academic conference on questions like this as well. And for that one, where it is actually sort of there's science being presented and stuff like that, that one might wind up being a little bit more kind of like 24 hours over a small period, where, you know, so we're assuming that there are going to be people who are just can't make sometimes and can make others, and just so it'll be kind of running all the time. But I think Kansas Fest was probably going to be designed for North America, basically. You know, possibly not Kansas City time exactly, but so it'll be rougher if you're in Japan. But anyway, so I just wanted to mention that before we went to commercial.
Very good. Our sponsor's been patiently waiting. And now, a word from our sponsor.
Who builds the computer power of more small businesses, medium-sized businesses, and big businesses as well? Computerland. Period.
And we're back. See how quick that goes? All right. Let's talk about a retro computing gift idea. Don't you guys want to wear floppy disks? I know I do.
I do.
Ideally.
I've always wanted this.
Yes. Now, I love these, so I'm going to describe them. They are patches. They're iron-on patches. They look like a 3.5-inch floppy disk. The surface of the floppy disk is blue. The metal part is metal-colored. And the label is also kind of curiously metal-colored. And does it say how big they are? I mean, I would hope that they're like actually 3.5-inch.
They're not quite. There's a picture of...
Not quite to scale?
Yeah, I don't know how large this person's hand is, but there's a picture of somebody holding it in their hand.
Oh, yes. Yes, unless their hand is gargantuan, then these are not quite 3.5, but that's fine.
It says it's 2 by 2 inches.
Well, they're pretty neat. I kind of wish there was a 5.25 version, because those were the true diskettes, the ones that I grew up with. I never really recognized 3.5-inch diskettes. I reject their existence.
Refuse to recognize them.
Yes. But no, these are cool, though. And one of the things that I like is that they're not expensive. So I'm seeing this as, I think, in British pounds for £1.55.
Well, that's interesting. We're all seeing different.
I see it in Canadian, though. For me, it says $7.61.
Yeah, for me, it's also in Canadian dollars.
As it should be. By the way, big news, Canada just took over while you weren't looking. You all stayed home, and we snuck in. And I'd like to say sorry, because that's what we do.
That is so weird. Why am I seeing it in a different currency? I don't care. Yeah. They're inexpensive, and that is a cool thing. So be the first on your block to have these patches.
Patches? Not stinky patches.
So, Carrington, we want to buy some more stuff.
Okay, then I will share a screen with you, because my thing is something that you really should see before you purchase. Paul is going to buy this immediately. It's a big googly-eyed duck mouse, and I love this thing. I don't know why this is as lovely as it is, but it's a PS2 mouse, and it's got a little cartoon duck on it and huge googly eyes, and the googly eyes are the buttons. I can't express how much I love this thing. I don't think it matters what it costs. I think we all have to have one. Your clicky keyboard is one thing, but your clicky eyed Google mouse is another. It's going for $30. It's an estate find. If I had an estate, it would be just full of these. I mean, this thing is amazing. This thing is truly a work of art and wonder.
It makes you wonder, why aren't all mice made this way?
I wouldn't have let them sell it. I would have made sure I was buried with this.
Isn't it the most amazing thing? I can't stop looking at it. And I have no need for a cartoon duck googly-eyed PS2 mouse.
Oh, yes, you do.
But part of my soul feels incomplete because I don't have this thing. It's gorgeous and silly. What? Why does this exist? I love it so much.
I'm just trying to imagine how it feels clicking on those eyes.
Oh, it just seems
big googly eyes.
It does seem like it would be a disincentive to click on things, wouldn't it?
Poking at the eye. Oh, don't poke me in the eye again. Dear listener, if you're not watching live, you don't get to see the googly eyed duck mouse. But it is a sight to behold, and I love it. I actually have two choices. So that's my first one. So, Paul, I think this thing is cheap. It is $30. Are you going to buy this? Next episode, will you be using googly-eyed mouse? Will I be able to sell you?
Well, in fact, somebody bought it before I would have been able to.
I've got a new link. The person said it was no longer available, and they've relisted it, I think, for more money.
Oh, I see.
And now had 40% off. Like, it's weird.
But there's a make offer.
This one is available.
There's a make offer.
There is a make offer, and this one is available for $30, marked down for $50, 40% off. I made a higher number. I don't understand what's happening here. Yeah. I love
Interesting.
It. I love it. I want it. I want Paul to have it. And actually, so.
I'm not sure that I will get it, will. I do kind of, just to keep going on that, I would like it if there was like the rubber duckies that you could get. If it would be such that if you press the eyeball, it would squeak in pain.
Squeak.
That would be even better.
Have you, then you would buy it? Okay, you
every time you click.
Excellent.
Ow. How?
And my second choice, which I'll just switch over here, I don't even think the link in the show notes yet, but I'll put it in, is a TRS-80 Model 1 computer case. I had a Model 1 super young, and I dig this thing. It's $129. I don't know that it's worth that. And these come up every once in a while, which all it really is a briefcase with foam cutouts and stuff to fit a Model 1. And it is great. If you're going to have a Model 1, though, this is a great way to have it and to store it away. And all it is a beat-up briefcase designed for Model 1. But it's the old black briefcase with the latches on the front, you know, your traditional briefcase. But it is specific for Model 1s. So you have your Model 1, a couple of cassettes, a cassette player, and the power supply all tuck in nicely into this briefcase so that Paul can have this to store one of his many Model 1s.
That's cool. Camouflage too, because it just looks like a nothing case when it's closed.
Just a briefcase.
Yeah. So you right. can
because it really is just a briefcase with foam cutouts. Yeah. You make this yourself, I guess. But it's a vintage thing. There's an included little advertisement that shows like this is how it was used. This is a thing that is from the day, this traditional black briefcase thing, but it really is just a self briefcase. I just dig it. I don't know if I dig it $130, but certainly Paul should buy it.
I don't have a Model 1.
Oh, so then once you get this, then you got to buy a Model 1.
You need a Model 1 then. Yeah, clearly.
I had a Model 1 and I loved it. But that's one of those ones where once I moved on to a computer with color, I was like, there's no looking back. Yeah, right. I can't. Because there were not a lot of good games on the Model 1. I got it hoping to play games. I was a kid. And it was a wasteland of games, man.
Yeah, it's funny. I had some experience with the Model 3 that a friend of mine had, but this reminds me that something I was going to say back at the very beginning, that like I actually had, because the, you know, we had all these cliques or whatever, like, you know, the Commodore kids and the Apple kids or whatever. But a lot of the people I knew, it was sort of out of their control. It was, you know, their parents bought a Model 3, you know, their parents bought a Commodore.
Totally.
These parents bought a VIC-20 and, you know, different ones have bought a PC, you know, an IBM PC. I knew someone who had a TI-99/4A. I mean, like, actually, I knew people who had all of these things. And it was just because the parents looked at it and said, wow, this one seems like it's got some merit and is cheap. And then the kids built their identities around them and had fights.
But how is that different than every other identity we have?
That's so true.
Name your thing. We all just got it because we were raised in that house.
Yeah.
It was tough to do games for the Model 1. I actually wrote a game for the Model 1 when I was in high school.
Cool.
It was kind of a takeoff of Space Invaders. We called it Toast the Quimnax. And
of course you did.
Yeah.
This was a school rivalry?
No. We had some time in the computer lab at lunch and we had a Model 1. And so
and you hated Quimnax.
I had a buddy of mine that called any arcade game like Space Invaders or Asteroids or wherever, to all of those games to him were Toast the Quimnax. That was the phrase he used. So I thought, got to write a game because that's an amazing title. And the game sounded something like this.
Yeah.
Because there was no sound on the Model 1. So
I like it.
Nice. So Earl, I think you're up next. What are you going to pitch Paul on purchasing?
Well, I actually stole one of Paul's auctions. So I am definitely the Hamburglar of the show notes this time around. But this is a Pi 1541 hardware component, which probably requires a little explanation. Pi 1541 is a project to take a Raspberry Pi and program it at the bare metal level to emulate a 1541 disk drive. And the emulation of the 1541 disk drive in this case is amazingly good, like cycle accurate, like it could do everything a real 1541 nice. Could do.
Except read disks.
That's right.
And I bet it can't make those marvelous noises 1541 could make.
You would say that, and then you would be wrong, because it does actually even simulate some of the sounds of the 1541.
Fantastic.
Oh.
That is loving attention to detail is what that is. Nice.
So what this auction is for is the hardware piece that you need to physically connect your Raspberry Pi to the Commodore computer. You need to either build such a thing, you know, looking around for spare parts and Commodore disk drive connectors and that kind of thing, or you need to buy something that it sits on top of the GPIO pins on the Raspberry Pi, the pins on the Pi that allow you to interface with the real world, and handles all the voltage conversions that you need in order to deal with the 3.3 to 5 volt changes from the Raspberry Pi to a real Commodore. It has an OLED display, which can show you things like what disk image you currently have loaded. And it shows you other things too. I actually built my own Pi 1541 interface, and I think, although I'm not 100% sure, that I destroyed my Raspberry Pi 3 in the process. Because I goofed something up on the wiring, and now whenever I plug in my Raspberry Pi 3, it thinks it has low voltage even when it doesn't. So I think I messed something up. You're probably better off thinking through that to buy a hardware interface made by somebody who's doing it at least quasi-professionally.
Exactly, and for less than $30, it saves you a ton of time and scrounging up parts. Mm-hmm. And for less than $30, you've got it done with this little display. Like that seems really cheap to me for what you're getting.
Yep, and this auction is one such instance of that. There are other sellers who do it as well. This particular seller has 100% positive feedback, so that seems like a good thing. Mm-hmm. And you're right, it's under $30 US. The Pi 1541 is a neat project, inspired in the way that it just completely, because you know, 1541 is a bit of a problematic device to emulate in hardware because it was a full computer on its own, just like some of the other computers like the Atari disk drives that interfaced over a serial port and had their own brains. The 1541 had its own brains, its own ROM. And so to really do it justice, you need to work hard for full compatibility. That's what they've done on that project. Sweet. So that's that auction.
I always think of this as kind of like the dream, you know, like a little hat that you can put on your Raspberry Pi that will make the interfacing to whatever computer you want to do. So like the power is provided by the Pi in some consistent, you know, consistent way, and you can just buy a bunch of hats for them.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I completely agree. Like that's what I want is kind of a Lego solution where I snap this to this and I plug it in there and I'm good to go.
So, Paul, you've got the next ones.
I do. Okay.
I do.
All right. So the first one, I just thought this was interesting because I don't see these come up very often. This is a TRS-80 Model 16B. I don't actually know what the B stands for in a Model 16B.
Backyard, apparently.
Yeah. Yeah. It's sitting on the driveway and kind of like, slightly after the rain.
So just like the photo you had earlier with people taking their computers for a walk. Same thing. Like this computer just needed to get outside for a bit.
But so I'm not sure that it's maybe not in the best condition for such a thing, but it doesn't look like it's in too bad shape. The keys are kind of yellow. I really don't know about this, like having put it on the ground stuff, but the back panel is not attached, but it is included. And they show a little picture of the inside of it, and you know, it looks like what I would have expected such a thing to look like. I vaguely remember hearing that these things are pretty difficult to keep intact, you know, that they're sort of among the TRS-80, you know, desktop line there, among the hardest to kind of deal with. But and there's always, you know, like there's always a shipping question because I think it's easily chipped plastic. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't appear to necessarily work. I mean, like there's something that happens on the screen, you know, so it might be fixable. It might not be easily fixable. I don't know. But I think it's rare enough that, and it looks like it's intact enough that if this is the kind of thing you were looking for.
And it's only up to $3.25 bid-wise.
Yeah. I mean, it's in St. Louis, Missouri. They will ship it. It's listed, shipping to me, it's listed as $100. But I mean, there's currently basically no bids on it. I mean, there's three bids and it's gone up to $3.25. So $3.25.
$3.25. $3.25. Yeah.
They've talked about some of these more exotic TRS-80 models on Trash Talk quite a bit on that podcast. And they've always been fascinating to me, these business style TRS-80 computers. Never had the chance to even see one. Have you guys ever even seen one in person?
I don't think so.
No, nope. Not in person.
Though I do listen to the Trash Talk podcast, I would recommend that. I like that one.
Yeah, I'm not caught up on that either, but I do remember them talking a bit about this particular model, which is, you know, like all I know about the fragility of the Model 16 is from that podcast.
Mm. There are some systems that are just hard to ship, like, yeah, you know, the VT100 series of terminals. They're big. I think the plastic gets a little bit brittle over time. Mm-hmm. If you ship one, you know, there's a lot of computers or terminals that if you ship, it's so risky.
Yeah.
Yeah. Combination of brittle plastic and heavy internals,
right,
lead to getting knocked around inside. I see a lot of, not a lot, but now and then someone will post like a sad, sad result of buying an Atari 800 that someone is just, the shipper just throws it in a big old box, mm-hmm, and it's just, it's just pieces.
Yeah.
The case is just totally shattered.
The Atari 800 has so much weight.
Yeah.
So that means it would have a lot of momentum when it starts to go.
It's like a cannonball. Yeah. Like a cannonball inside crumbly old plastic, and it just falls apart.
Well, and also it's all of these little like vent things or whatever, like all these little, I believe I have two such destroyed Atari 800s.
Yeah. That hurts. Especially it hurts because the 800 is one of my, yeah, favorite industrial designs.
Right.
Just to look at,
yep,
it is such a work,
yep,
of art.
Yep.
It hurts to think of one getting destroyed. I know they're not like super rare, but they're so beautiful. I don't want any of those precious little snowflakes to get broken.
But yeah, I think, I mean, a lot of this kind of computer also have a lot of space inside, you know, so they're, it's plastic, it's heavy stuff, it's space, and like nothing sort of supporting it inside. Mm-hmm. So, it, you know, if the heavy stuff breaks off at all, it just bounces around inside. So, yeah, I don't know. I don't know what the solution is. I mean, like, drive it over to, you know, like courier it personally to wherever it's going, I guess.
I don't publicly shame people who ship things improperly.
Yeah.
Well, okay, it never
first
does
of all,
any good.
A lot of nerd culture is about publicly shaming people who ship stuff inappropriately. So I don't know if I get on board.
Yeah. Are you using a different sense of ship?
A ship, yeah. I make a little okay, joke there.
Very nice.
Other shipping.
Okay, let's see. Now moving on to the next one. This is an auction that I'm not interested in, but it is. It's a bunch of. I looked at it because it had a title that you know made me look at it. It's a bunch of. It's basically a bunch of Apple manuals and. I have nothing against these. It's just that they're all relatively common, and so I personally have like four of every one of them at least, and you know they just come with every other things that you get. You know, so they're Apple IIe manual, DOS manual, whatever, logo manual, slightly rare.
But I find that I'll see these lots of manuals for Apple II or other things, and it's almost like a compulsion that I have to open up the video and scan through them quick to make sure there's not something there. I'm like, oh my goodness, look at that thing.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I definitely,
because you never
I
know.
Always look at these just because there might be something in there that I hadn't seen.
Yeah.
But
there isn't here as far as I know.
So the other, you know, I didn't see anything. I mean, like the right. Some of these things, like the logo ones are maybe a little bit more uncommon, but none of these come with software either. So, but one thing I often do too, when I see little things like this that are kind of like jumbles of things, it kind of suggests that maybe somebody's cleaning out their house. They don't know what any of this stuff is. This is like, you know, grandpa's old stuff. And so I usually check the other things that the seller is selling. And another thing that the seller was selling is the Black Hole Color Forms Adventure Set, which doesn't have anything to do with retro computing at all. But it's just, it struck me as something I had not thought about in a long time. Black Hole and
me
Color
neither.
Forms.
I absolutely had Color Forms. I don't even think I really even liked them as a kid, but I have a distinct memory of having these things. Maybe even this one. Peel these things off and they kind of stick sort of with static and you build a little scene and my goodness. The things we did before the internet.
The weird thing I remember about those is the smell. That kind of vinyl plastic combined with adhesive kind of sort of. I remember them just kind of smelling weird. My hands always smelled weird after I played with these. That's my lovely memory.
It is a weird material they're made of.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. But anyway, I mean, I really had not thought about Color Forms at all for a decade.
Yeah, at least a decade. My goodness. I forgot that was even a thing that existed, but I 100% had them.
Yep. So I was pleased enough to see this that I just thought I had to mention it, even though it...
Yep. Or the Black Hole. I haven't thought of the Black Hole in forever.
Yeah, I was too young for it just by a little bit. So like I would have liked it, but by the time I was interested in that stuff, there were newer movies, you know.
Right. So, okay. I remember seeing it, I think, in the cinema and liking it.
Yeah, I did too. I saw it in the cinema and liked it, but I was, you know, 8 or something, I guess.
Well, I was in my 20s, but you know.
I saw it when it was new, and I was a kid, and I liked it. And then I don't think I've seen it ever again. But then I remember a year.
It's got some weird darkness to it for a Disney film.
Right.
You watch it again. I've seen it in more modern times. You're like, whoa, that's an odd scene to include.
I should maybe watch it again.
Yeah.
There are many color forms currently available on eBay. So if you don't like that, Knight Rider. Like, there's a lot. I've gone down an eBay color forms rabbit hole while we're discussing this.
Perfect. Just my plan is working.
Yeah. Spider-Man, Mork and Mindy, so many color forms.
Okay, let's see. The next thing I had, this just caught my attention because I identify with the frustration that led to the creation of this. It is a 3D printed power button replacement. So this is for the Power Mac 7200, 7300, 7500, 7600. All of these Macs have behind their plastic front plate, there's like a hole, and then there's this little, you know, circle that pokes through, and you push on it and it starts the thing. And it's sort of kept in place by this kind of like bow, plastic bow, that provides the tension. And what ends up, you know, there's just a button on the motherboard behind it that gets hit, right? But the thing is that the plastic gets old. These things are in a super vulnerable place, and so like half the ones that I have are broken. it's being 3D printed with like red material, but the button itself is in an acceptable color for poking through the front. I think it's good that this exists. It's $30, but I mean, like, it might just save you that much sort of annoyance.
Hmm. Right.
I don't think there's much more to say about that. It's just I wanted to point it out because I understand why that exists. And then the last thing, I just thought this was kind of interesting. I didn't, you know, maybe everybody knows that this exists. Maybe this is totally rare, but for the Atari Lynx, which has come up a couple of times in the past, there was an official... It looks like an official Atari branded carrying case that you could put your Lynx in. So if you have a Lynx or were interested in getting a Lynx, this is a place you could carry it around in. You know, it's sort of form fit to fit the Lynx in the cartridges and things like that. And I just thought it was kind of interesting that it even, you know, that it was a thing and that it's still possible to find one.
Cool.
Yeah, I had a Lynx, but I did not have this case.
I think one Lynx that I saw for sale here in Sweden recently had that case, was in that case.
Uh-huh.
I didn't buy it, though. It got out of my price range.
Yeah, I imagine. I didn't actually look to see how expensive this was. I think it's $50. So it's not crazy if you had a Lynx. And right. The box is in pretty good shape. I mean, like, if you're trying to – oh, look, there's a place you can plug it into your cigarette lighter.
Mm-hmm. It's got to make offer.
It does. That's true. And it's in Colorado Springs, Colorado.
Cool.
But, cool. Listener Blake – reports that he has that case and pulled his Lynx out of it last time to show us.
Listener Blake, if he wants to contribute to the show, can be on the show. Listener Blake, how does he become the listener again? Hey, Blake, where are you, man?
I think he had a family, you know, birthday party exactly. Or something.
But also let us steal your stuff. Blake, we're in your show stealing your Lynx.
It worked out very well. Lynx,
we stole all of yours.
But we do miss you.
Yeah.
We do indeed.
Anyway, and with that, I have concluded my eBay list.
Well, excellent. I guess we're off to closing discussions then. Blake, anything to add? Carrington, why don't you go ahead?
Alphabetical, I got nothing. I'm sitting inside my house like everybody is supposed to mm-hmm. be, and I'm doing as few things as I can, and I'm playing a lot of old computer games, particularly Infocom games for Eaten by Gru. So I'm currently struggling my way through Station Fall. It's hard, and I'm not doing well. So I haven't cheated yet, but I'm plugging away.
Any minute now.
Any minute now. This afternoon, I may start looking at some of his clues. I've been stumped for a week in this game. Liking it, but I'm stumped at the
moment. Well, I love that podcast. So
after we wrap up, I'll go
super
back.
Super stoked that there are new episodes.
Yep. Oh yeah, we're 100% going to finish all the Infocom games. We've only got two more of the after this. We've got two more, you know, text only ones, and then we'll do the three or four, however number kind of post text Infocom games there were. Whether we'll do more things after that, I don't know. But we're committed 100% to do at least every Infocom.
You've only got a handful left though, right?
Yep. Yep, just a couple, two more after this. After Station Fall, we've got
the
Lurking Horror, and well, we do. We're totally going to do that. Absolutely, we'll do Cornerstone. We got Lurking Horror, and the one of the ones that starts with a W. I can never, not wizardry. I always want to call it wizardry.
The, witness, maybe?
Nope, not witness. Give me another W info code.
Wishbringer?
I think I would know. Wishbringer, there you go. We got to do Wishbringer. I can never remember that. That's probably why we haven't done that one. I can't remember its title.
That was pretty impressive. That was Lurking impressive Horror. Guessing.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, I've been meaning to play Lurking Horror because it's based on MIT.
So. Exactly. I have been, that's the, of all the games, weirdly, Lurking Horror is the one I have most looked forward to. And so we're like 3.5 years into doing the show and we're about to finally do the one that I've really wanted to do. And almost certainly it's going to let me down. There's no, I've now built it up so much in my head. So we will see. But it is the one of all of the games that I have most looked forward to doing. So it'll either be our next one after this episode or the one after that. It'll be one of the two next episodes will be my well, not necessarily favorite, but the one I'm most looking forward to. So we'll see. Anyway, that's what I got retro-wise. Playing a lot of Infocom games.
Excellent. I guess I'm next off of Backley. I want to revise my earlier statement, Senator. The one thing that I want people to know about that Pi 1541 in the audio is that the sounds it makes are just kind of beeps and boops. They're not really that really satisfying, like tick, 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 that you get with the head recalibration or stuff like that. So. It's a sound. You know, it gives you some audio feedback of what it's doing.
As an Apple II user, I really can't judge the sounds of any retro device.
Oh my gosh. I love the sound of the Apple II, the floppy drive when it boots up.
Yep.
But I meant the computer.
Yeah. Oh.
Beeps and boops are.
Exactly. Beeps and boops. I don't know. I don't know if we can offer both beeps and boops.
No, simultaneously.
The Prince of Persia source code revealed an Easter egg that they had at the beginning. I probably mentioned this before, but where there was a thing you could basically play with a paddle, where if you booted it and held down a particular key or whatever, it would make your disk drive sound like a motorcycle that you could like change the speed. You know, so if you can't get the speaker to give you what you want, you can try to use the physical clacking of the disk drive.
And I'm sure that was awesome for the disk drive itself, too.
I'm sure.
Yeah. I'm sure, yes. Oh, I should point out in the comments on the live stream, Blake also nailed that it was Wishbringer before any of us figured it out. He's not even on the show and he goes more than we do.
Nice. Very cool.
Yeah, nice.
Jack, you're next.
Yeah, I don't really have anything. I think all of my retro computing projects are laying on a shelf waiting for my attention. One of these days, I will get around to it. I shouldn't busy myself with other stuff.
All of us will have on our tombstones. One of these days, I will get around to it.
Yes.
The nerd credo.
Mark my words.
I've got that for multiple hobbies. So it's just going exponential on me. Paul, why don't you land the plane?
Yeah. Well, and I also don't have – it's possible that I've started a few things.
Cool.
I can't finish a single project. I am – halfway through editing the previous episode. So I think people were liking it there for a little while. There was like a little rush of Retro Computing Roundtable episodes that hit the feed because I was just catching up. But mm-hmm. So I will, that will happen again. But
Christmas in April.
No, I think I'm looking forward to having a little bit more discretionary time now that, the work that I do, you know, is at least changing to allow for a little bit more flexibility. But anyway, yeah, so no real retro stuff to report yet, but I have ideas.
Cool.
Fair enough.
Good.
Well, okay then. That's it for this show. Get out of here. Find show notes for
still
all.
Here? Go home.
You can find show notes for all the RCR shows at rcrpodcast.com. We like that domain because it's like so close to our podcast. Discuss in the forums at vcfed.org/forum/forum.php. You can follow RCR on Twitter at RCR Podcast. You can join our Facebook group. Hundreds of people have, so it can't be wrong. You can send feedback to feedback@rcrpodcast.com. We're a member of the Throwback Network, which you can find at throwbackreviews.com. If you'd like, you can write a review for the podcast on iTunes. Not too long ago, did I mention this last show? Not too long ago, I went cruising around through iTunes and actually looked at some of the reviews. And folks said just some really nice stuff about the podcast. And I'm very happy about that. Thankful that you took the time to write a review. And it was just really nice to read. So thank you.
I'm glad that they're following our instructions.
That's right. Yes. Soon our instructions will become even more diabolical.
Step three, profit. And until next time,
Retro Compute.